Through the sometimes dangerous Middle East. At one point, he was even detained by the police, along with Freddie, and he was taking some photographs that he probably wasn't supposed to, but he'll be showing some pictures later. He spent years learning Persian and was able to translate documents previously not available and also do his own Rumi translations. Brad became a member of a Sufi group and for a while, a whirling dervish. Rumi's poems are universally loved, both by Americans and all over the world. Now, Brad Gooch brings vivid life to this Persian poet and Sufi mystic. Stacy Schiff said, Brad Gooch brings both the life of the spirit and the magic of the poet to the page in his informative, enhancing, sumptuous biography. Brad Gooch is a professor of English at William Paterson University in New Jersey. He's the author of 12 books, including the widely praised Flannery, A Life of Flannery O'Connor, City Poet, The Life and Times of Frank O'Hara, and Smash a Cut. His writing has appeared in numerous magazines and newspapers. And now let us welcome Jack Whitehead.
I mentioned book tour. This book came out about 2 months ago, so I've been going places and doing some interviews, and well, because of that, I know what questions everyone wants to know, sort of crowdsourced. And there are three of them, so I'm going to answer them tonight. And then if you have any others at the end, you can ask them. One is, how did you come to write about Rumi? And who's Rumi? Still get to ask. Which happened to me when I was writing this book, that half the time people would look kind of perplexed when I said what I was doing, and the other half would light up and say, Rumi's my favorite poet. And the last was, why Rumi, or why are we interested in Rumi in 2017 instead of 1997 or 1307? How I came to write about Rumi is, like most people, I think I was drawn first to the poetry, and I was staying in a friend's house in Miami one week in the early 1990s, and on the shelf were the two-volume translation by this Cambridge don, A.J. Arbery, of the poems of Rumi. And I read through them all in a week and was sort of mesmerized, puzzled, mystified, seduced, and they kept, you know, sort of vaguely glowing in my brain. And then I think 1995, one Christmas, I received the same Christmas gift from three different people unknowingly, which was The Essential Rumi by Coleman Barks. And these were the translations that really created a sort of Rumi craze, like the Omar Khayyam craze in England. Earlier, so there were lines like out beyond right doing and wrong doing, there is a field, I will meet you there. And there were, you'd see bumper stickers with these lines on. Deepak Chopra and Madonna were recording Rumi poetry at that moment. And then towards the end of that decade, around 1999, I was writing a book called God Talk, Travels in Spiritual America, and the last chapter was on Muslims in New York City. So for this report, I kind of joined this Sufi group who met on the Upper West Side of Manhattan every Friday night at the apartment of Imam Fazl Rauf, who later became sort of notorious for being at the center of the Ground Zero mosque controversy. This was a more intimate and innocent moment. Imam Faisal's main person was Rumi, but not so much the Rumi of the lyric poetry, but Rumi, who, as spiritual leader, whose talks had been, he would read from the talks of Rumi that had been written down in a book called Fiyeh Mafi. This great title could be translated as, It Is What Is In It. And also from this group was mainly made up of young Muslim Americans in their 20s and 30s. There are families from different backgrounds, Central Asia, Turkey, Iran, North Africa, Europe, Canada, both Sunni and Shia. And from them, I got more of a sense of the context of Rumi's life, history and culture, and also his life story, which I think the writer in me thought sort of that's a great story. That book came out, God Talk, right after 9/11, and I had this idea of writing a life of Rumi. I went, mentioned it to some publishers, and they all sort of paled at the idea of a book about a Muslim religious leader and poet at that time. And I wrote Flannery, as you mentioned, and 6 years later, still had this Rumi idea. And then when I talked about it, everything was completely different. Everyone thought it was a great idea and very interesting. I'm not sure why. I think partly because of our tragic involvement in that part of the world than Afghanistan, Iraq. The geography was more familiar. Terms like Sunni and Shia were now in our discourse and in the news. And so I set out to, on this project, to sort of put a face and a context to this floating name of Rumi, who at that time, especially half the people I talked to would think that he was Buddhist, for instance. I mean, people really didn't have a sense of the historical Rumi. This was a labor of love, took 8 years, but I think I hadn't thought through the labor entirely. So first I realized I needed to study Farsi or Persian. And I went to two immersion programs, one at the University of Texas Austin, one at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where you would live in a dorm with your fellow students and speak Farsi 24/7. Most of them were 19 years old. Literally had K in my Persian. I mean, in my room. So that was the first part, and then I set out to research the book. But first, before turning to Rumi's life, I just wanted to read a couple of these the poems of Rumi to remind us of his voice, which I think is finally what voice, imagery, vision kind of always draws people. These are the translations I did with Maryam Mortaz, who was my translator, a tutor, and who was an Iranian-American writer, and then her role kind of grew in the writing of the book to co-translating the poems and a lot of prose that haven't been translated. Where is the grace I saw in your face all night? Where is the grace I saw in your face all night? Such a sweet story I heard from you all night. Although your flame burned the moth of my heart, I circled around the flame of your beautiful face all night. Before your beautiful moon-like face, night veiled itself. I ripped apart the veil of night all night. My soul, full of joy, licked itself like a cat. Like a baby, I sucked my thumb all night. My chest, like a beehive full of buzzing, from you, the source of honey, I drank nectar all night. The trap of night was set, capturing everyone's souls. My heart, like a bird, throbbed in that trap all night. All souls, like doves, are under his command. Within its trap, I desired him all night. I've lost myself, but am longing to lose myself more. I've lost myself, but am longing to lose myself more. I tell your eyes that I am longing to be as drunk as you. I don't long for a crown. I don't long for a throne. I long to bow to the ground in your service. My beautiful beloved grabs me by the throat. You say, what do you long for? I say, this. I long for the morning breezes to breathe. I have my breath, but long for someone to tell my secrets to. I'm in the circle of pilgrims. I'm safe from misfortune. I'm wax beneath your seal, longing for the press of your ring. Another moon is hiding inside the moon. I'm sure of this truth as I look into your true eyes. So I then set out to trace Rumi's life. It was kind of a map of 2,500 miles that extends from Tajikistan, where now I believe he was born in 1207, to Konya in Turkey, where he dies in 1273. These are just maps, but I have them made for the book just because one trick was always remembering that none of these the nation states that exist now are around then. So trying to remember that where Rumi was born was the Khorasan, the eastern part of the old Persian Empire, and his family traveled across all this terrain over a decade. He was said born in Tajikistan, and when I was driving into Dushanbe, with Fred Eberstadt was with me in that, on that trip sitting back there, and there was this picture. We don't have any images of Rumi from his life, and this one seemed the closest to my sort of idea of Rumi. So when I took the photograph of it, also not only do we not have any images, he probably wasn't known as Rumi by any, or called Rumi by anyone in his life. That really means from Rome, and Rome referring to the old Byzantine Roman Empire, which where he winds up in what's now Turkey. When he was born, his name was Mohammed, and like many boys in the neighborhood, and when he was 6 years old, he told his father that he was seeing angels, and his father, who was a, he came from a family of Muslim preachers and teachers and jurists, sort of encouraged this and gave him these honorific titles, Code of Angar, Jalal al-Din, Glory of the Faith. As an adult, he was known as Mulana, our teacher, from which we get the Turkish Mevlana, from the Mevlevi order of whirling dervishes, the thing that grew up around him after his death. This is the village of Santuta, which is on the spot of Baksh, where Rumi was probably born. And another aspect of this trip was that I think I did have a sort of orientalist fantasy when I started this book of going into this kind of mystical path of poetry and whirling dervishes, and actually writing this book kind of smashed up into more contemporary geopolitics than any book that I've written. So when we were leaving this village, for instance, Fred and I were detained for having visited with this older poet we had breakfast with, who's supposedly an expert on Rumi. But on the way out of town, we were sort of intercepted by these two cars with automatic rifles and taken off to this old Russian prison 15 miles from the border of Afghanistan. And the person who had taken us to meet the old poet was handcuffed to a pipe on the floor. And I found this terrifying. It was literally, my teeth were shaking. I discovered I was more of a coward than I realized. Fred was sort of kind of taking a nap. So maybe it wasn't all as serious as I thought. But, and in Tehran, my camera was swiped from my hand for taking the picture of the Ministry of Justice, and they tried to get me to follow them into the Ministry of Justice. Later in Aleppo, I was in Aleppo the day the civil war broke out in Syria. So many reminders of our chaotic world, which in some way matched, and reminders of how chaotic Rumi's own world had been. So this is the landscape of Tajikistan, the mountains. Rumi's family leaves when he's about six. It's not clear whether they were just going on Hajj to Mecca, if there was some political situation, local political situation that they were leaving behind. But by the time they did get to Mecca and Syria, they discovered that they were homeless, basically, and displaced persons and fugitives, immigrants, because Genghis Khan and the Mongols had come down and destroyed all of these great cities of Rumi's homeland. One was Samarkand, where we had Rumi's first memory when he was 6 years old. It was of being in a siege in Samarkand, and the family then travels through Iran. I actually have pictures here from Shiraz of the tomb of Hafez, just to show that in terms of the culture in Iran there's this great excitement and reverence and interest around poets. And so you go to the grave of a poet, and there are hundreds of people reading aloud the poems, and you know, it's sort of a crowd scene. Then I also went through Syria, where Rumi went to madrasa or college in Damascus. And then these are pictures of Aleppo, which when I was there, you could pretty much recreate in your mind the Aleppo that Rumi had seen in the 10th century minaret, was still there, the mosque, the bazaar. All these things have been now leveled in just the last couple of years. But here's the bazaar. And basically, I think what I discovered was that Rumi's life, or the way I interpreted it, kind of fell into a three-act structure. The first being this whole period of his youth that went on over a decade of his family traveling until they wind up in Konya, what's now Turkey, part of the Seljuk Empire. Seljuks were Turkic Muslims, but they were ruling a land that was 80% Christian, Greeks and Armenians. And it brought in then these displaced Persian scholars, teachers, poets, to sort of teach the culture and the religion in an amenable way to the local population. And Rumi pretty much follows in his father's path, becomes kind of well-known jurist and charismatic preacher and teacher by the time he's 37 years old. And then everything is disrupted. And the sort of second act of his life only lasts for about 3 years, but really transforms him. And this happens because of his meeting with Shams of Tabriz, who was about 60 years old, itinerant mystic who had been traveling around the Middle East, studying with all of his teachers, like Ibn Arabi, comes to town, meets Rumi. It's made still important enough that there's this little, looks like a bus stop, but kind of a shrine, a monument marking the spot where Rumi and Shams of Tabriz supposedly met. And I mean, they did meet, but I'm not exactly certain it was there, in 1244. And Shams of Tabriz is, they have enough of a kind of electric connection that Rumi goes off into seclusion with Shams for 3 months and then again later for 6 months. And this disrupts Rumi's world, which is he has a family, he has now his second wife, he has three children, he has posts, teaching posts in four different colleges. And Shams of Tabriz is basically then trying to encourage Rumi to shift from a path of knowledge to a path of love in the heart, and to give up the writing of fatwas and sermons, and to write poems and practice music and this whirling dance that he's teaching him as a meditation. And a lot of the great kind of Rumi poems, especially the Rubaiyat quatrains, are about this kind of aha moment in his life. I'll read it in Persian just so you can, in my broken Persian, so you can. Ta dar dele man eshketo handukhte sho, joz eshketo harche dashtam sukhte sho, elmo se bako khetab bartak nahad, shero gezalo dobe ti amukhte sho. When your love inflamed my heart, all I have is burned to ashes except your love. I put logic and learning and books on the shelf and learned the art of poetry and song. So Rumi is going through this transformation with Shams of Tabriz. Meanwhile, this creates extraordinary anxiety and dissonance everywhere else. I think if you were central casting and you were looking for the idea of a spiritual teacher, you wouldn't pick Shams of Tabriz, who was a very kind of misanthropic character who caused a lot of trouble, didn't suffer fools gladly, was very interested in Rumi and nobody else. This caused a disturbance with Rumi's children, and there were always reports of people drawing knives on Shams of Tabriz when he walked down the street and muttering threats. Partly because of this, Shams disappears one day from Tabriz with no explanation of his leaving. Rumi hears that he's in Aleppo in Syria, and he begins then writing poems. In this case, they're letter poems in Arabic at the beginning, to Shams to try to convince him to come back. He sends his son, Sultan Balad, off with these letters and letter poems, and they convince Shams of Tabriz to return. All this takes about a year, and then he does. They start up again, basically the same patterns reemerge for a while. Shams is even married to a young woman in Rumi's household, Kimia, but who dies that winter, putting another dark cloud over Shams of Tabriz, and then Shams just really disappears without a trace. We still don't entirely know what happened to Shams of Tabriz. There are different tombs of Shams throughout the Middle East. This is the one always thought to be the most likely in near Tabriz in Iran, and also the earliest. But for the longest time, then Rumi can't really accept, and also doesn't really know if Shams is alive or not, and has a kind of meltdown, a sort of skirting of madness around Shams' disappearance, and begins using this dance, the whirling dance, to hold on to his sanity, to feel some connection with Shams of Tabriz, with God, and likewise starts using poetry in the same way. He hears that Shams is in Damascus and goes off for a year to Damascus. And this is when you get this outpouring of poetry. So all the poems of Rumi that we have and that we read were written after he was 40 years old. So between the time he's 40 and 67, he writes 3,000 ghazal, which are like sonnets, over 2,000 rubaiyat, which are quatrains, a six-volume spiritual epic called the Masnavi in couplets, and talks, and even have letters of Rumi. So at least the genius in that sense uses more metrical patterns than any other Persian poet of the time. But also, it interestingly uses the conventions of Persian poetry to deal with his own issues of the disappearance of Shams of Tabriz and reconciling human and divine love. The one way is that there's a convention in Persian poetry called the takalos, in which it's kind of a signature. The poet puts his name into the last line of the poem, and Rumi starts using Shams of Tabriz as his takalos. So when these poems are first collected, they're collected as the poems of Shams of Tabriz. So Rumi's not just saying he was inspired by Shams or influenced by Shams, but the Shams is writing these poems through him. Also, the name Shams in Arabic means sun. So when Rumi's writing to the sun, is he writing to Shams? Is he writing to the natural sun? Is he writing to the eternal sun god? And in Persian, the pronoun u can either mean he, she, it, or God. So this is a game that then Rumi plays to exhaustion. And finally writes this very intelligent poetry in the sense of F. Scott Fitzgerald, an intelligent person can hold two opposite thoughts in their head at the same time. So when you're reading Rumi's poems, you always have to pull together human love and divine love. And that's almost their transformative effect, is the having those two together in that way. Eventually, then, Rumi comes to accept the death of Shams al-Tabriz in Damascus. He also has, at the same time, a kind of spiritual insight, so that he says that the one he was seeking was within himself. Why was I looking outside? And this notion that Shams, or the source of love, is within himself, is then this wisdom that he returns to Konya with. His son Sultan Bilal said that he had changed from a pious man to a mystic at that point. And he returns as a mystic and as a poet, and symbolically changes out of his dress, scholarly dress of the turban and the silk robes, and puts on a dark blue kind of rough cloak and a dark blue scarf that he ties around his head, and that becomes his clothing until the end of his life. Simultaneously the dress of a Sufi mystic and also a sign of mourning in some way. At the center of his practice, then, he gives up giving sermons entirely and is using dance and music for teaching, and then especially his long poem, the Masnavi. As the story goes, once Rumi had then two beloved figures after Shams al-Tabriz, one Salah al-Din, who was an illiterate goldsmith who he had give his sermons and teach his classes. Seemed like a joke on the system in some way. And then after that, Husam al-Din, who was 20 years younger than he was and who wrote down all of his poetry. And so in a sense, there was almost these were collaborations. The Husam anyways came to Rumi one night and said, "Molana, all of your students aren't reading their Sufi manuals. They spend all their time reading these poems by Attar, like Conference of the Birds. Why don't you write your own Masnavi teaching poem?" At which point, Rumi supposedly took out from his scarf the page on which he'd written the first 16 lines of this Masnavi poem in the rhythm that had been requested, it has one of the more beautiful and famous openings in world literature. Beshnoz Nech Chekayat Mukonad, Ashjodaya Hekayat Mukonad, Kazne Stan Tamara Bubrida An, Dar Nafiran Marjazan Nalida An. Listen to the reed flute and the tale that it tells, how it sings of separation. Ever since I was cut from my bed of reeds, men and women have joined in my lament. I keep seeking other hearts, torn by separation, to share my tale of painful longing. Everyone cut at the root, longing for the time when they were joined. I've sung for them all, both the happy and the sad. Out of curiosity, they drew close to me, but none discovered my secret. My secret is woven in my lament, yet no eyes or ears can find its light. Soul is woven in body and body in soul, yet no eyes have the power to see the soul. Fire, not wind, makes this flute sing. If you don't have fire, don't play. So I think that Rumi, in the last part of his life and through the writing of the Masnavi, actually becomes more radical than Shams al-Tabriz and really develops this notion of a religion of lovers, which is beyond all faiths. He basically compares his poem to the Quran and the writing of poetry as being divinely inspired. He sets up as a hero Hallaj, who was a Sufi who was executed for saying I am the truth. So in all these ways, he was approaching the line. And there were fatwas brought against Rumi during his lifetime and against Shams of Tabriz. He then uses his death as a teaching moment, also writing lines like, if you come to visit my tomb, be sure to bring a tambourine. And those things which are inscribed on his shrine in Konya, where if you go, there can be 5,000 people a day visiting Rumi's shrine. And because of this double persona of him as poet and saint, you know, it's both the people that you saw at Hafez, tomb reading aloud the poems in Persian, Turkish, English, but also he's a religious saintly figure. So women are putting on veils and praying also in this shrine. And his at his funeral, where he arrived at this spot, it was actually radical because there weren't just Quranic reciters, but also musicians, whirling dervishes, and people reciting Rumi's poetry. And in the procession were Christian priests reciting the Gospels and Jewish rabbi reciting the Psalms. This was considered innovative enough that some of the Rumi's followers had the funeral stopped because they felt it's being taken away from them. And the Parvaneh governor was brought in to adjudicate this. And the Christian priest said, well, you didn't realize how much time he was spending in the Armenian neighborhoods or in the Plato monastery Plato with us. You don't realize what you had there. And so the funeral went on. And walking out that night, a friend of Rumi's, the Sufi poet Araki, said he came into the world as a stranger and he left as a stranger. And there is always this nimbus of, I think, otherness and mystery about Rumi, which is part of his enduring interest. But the last question I brought up that I promised to answer was about Rumi now, because he's continued in different ways for 800 years, but he's also continuously reinvented, depending on the moment. So when the Orientalist in early 20th century, R.J. Nicholson, is translating the Masnavi, he would dress in robes and a tall Sufi hat while he was translating. I completely understand, but it was a very romantic notion of Rumi in a sense. I mentioned the 1990s, and it was taken up by New Age spirituality. My book was published 3 days before the inauguration of the current president, and this seems to have brought Rumi back into a different kind of focus. There were memes the day after the election, I remember, that went viral enough, I guess, where people have taken the, make Trump make America great signs and turn them into Rumi make America great signs, Putin asking fake. The realization that one of America's favorite poets, Rumi, is Muslim, and spent part of his life as an immigrant and displaced person and refugee, is all gives a different, makes also then the life of Rumi especially relevant at this moment, and his message provides a counter narrative. I mean, it's all about that there is aren't if he is Turk or Tajik, I'm close to him. There's no distinction between races, and since we worship the one God, then all religions must be one. Or the mosque inside the hearts of holy men is a place of worship for everyone. So these sort of messages that have made him an interfaith icon all now have almost add a hard edge to the soft center of Rumi's love poetry. So thank you. And then if anyone has a fourth or fifth question, there's a fourth question.
Could you say something about the Ghazal, which doesn't translate well into English? Why Persian as a language is so adapted to this form or vice versa?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have it in French also, where it's just one big thing or rhyme.
Is Persian a rhyme-rich language?
Yes, it's very easy. It's easy to rhyme, and so these poems have these. Rumi was working with musicians, and he was, I think, kind of setting things to a certain rhythm that was set up in meter. So there's a musicality in these, and there's rhyme, things that becomes. Then you have the two choices in translation, to try to rhyme, and be faithful in that way, which truncates things, or to be very free in another way. But the good news, I was talking to Jonathan Gillespie, he said, this was actually at your house, said, I think Rumi's translation improved. And it's sort of true. I mean, I read the most literal academic translations, the freest, almost beat poetry translations, and something does come through, right? And attracts people, even if it's a different meaning. You'll never have the original song. So the first question is about repetition. I mean, the way that, Robert Bly said to Coleman Barks at one point, these poems need to be released from their cages, talking about the Arbery and Nicholson translations of Rumi, so meaning academic translations. And Coleman Barks indeed did that. He'll be the first to tell you he doesn't know a word in Persian. He's never read the Quran, but he caught the spirit. There's something in the spirit that he didn't caught. And they do. First of all, repeat Rumi, and also, I was on the panel with Coleman where I was sure he was half improvising. Poems you want along, right? So they, all these methods. Repetition, Rumi, as I said, the Masnavi was written as a teaching poem. And Rumi would recite it to the students. He would compose it in public sometimes with the students in the hall. So it was designed to be, and it has a kind of sing-song quality to it almost. And with the rhyme. This is a Masnavi form. So the repetition can emphasize that. Also, Rumi's been a very permissive muse. There was a German poet, I forget his name, who died in the 1970s, and all of his poems, he said, were Rumi was writing the poems through him. So Rumi, Shams had written the poems through Rumi, and now Rumi is writing through him. When Firuzin Farr, a great Persian editor and scholar, made a kind of serious critical edition of Rumi in the 20th century, he excised a third of the poems they were ascribed to Rumi as being authentic. So there's also, through the centuries, people have just kind of added Rumi, made up poems, and so they were by Rumi. And it happens to me, people say that they see this line, you know, something online, they see these lines by Rumi, where are they from? And I've never seen them. And other people, Franklin Lewis said the same thing, the Rumi scholar at the University of Chicago. So there's a kind of permissiveness around that poem. Second question was how this changed me, or if it changed me. harder question. I think I wrote the book to be around, you know, in that poetry and in that way of seeing the world that Rumi had and trying to find that way. I probably don't understand how or if it changed me entirely, except for one thing, which is the part of the book that I had the most, it was this kind of stretch for me, it was in the last part of his life, and when Rumi's writing the last three books, especially the Masnavi, he's writing a lot about death. And but he was very death-ready, meaning he was longing for death. He said, Shams of Tabriz calls to me from one side, my disciples call to me from the other. Death is like a womb. He's been in it now for 9 months. It's time to be born, meaning die. And so that kind of longing for actual death. I can understand spirituality based in the present and having some material reality to it and things. I found that hard. And then but I did eventually, I think, get into Rumi's way of dealing, which is finally joy. I mean, Rumi's a great antidepressant in some way, that he finds joy, and that he found joy in death, and that becomes part of his teaching. And that did sort of alter my feelings around, my neurotic feelings around death in the middle of the night. How's that? You can use that in your... Yes.
I find it a little bit strange or upsetting that poems that are not by Rumi are being taken as if they were. It seems like a mistake. I'm sort of interested in the bibliographic aspect. I don't know anything about it, that so many poems were eliminated as particular poems, and yet more poems, inauthentic poems, are being circulated. My question is, can you say these poems are Rumi, and how many of these poems have been translated into English? Is it possible to get, I don't know, word version, so can I get a grasp of the sort of lay of the land of these poems based on what has been translated?
Yes. First of all, the Masnavi is entirely intact and entirely by Rumi. And if you go to Konya, you can see the original manuscript that was done after a year or two after his death, finally put together. And so we know this is all about. The questions came then with the Rubaiyat and the Ghazal. Rubaiyat especially, because they're four-line kind of poems, like the dramatic, easy enough to write. But supposedly that problem in Persian was reasonably dealt with in these editions by Firuzanfar in the 20th century. And then you get into questions of translation, and which come closer and more viable. There is an Everyman edition of Rumi that's a kind of potpourri anthology of different translators. It's sort of my favorite because you get the best kind of poems by these different translators, and you get a sense of the different translators who are I would think, no, because he does get something. I mean, that's a debate.
Most translators don't really read the language.
Well, that's
first translation by all these different poets. No one could read it.
Yeah, so it's taking, I mean, he uses these original translation, academic translations that are pretty literal, and he had someone doing them for him who was Professor Cuny, and he, you know, so he's coming from some, you know, from the authentic, and then he's sort of riffing on them in a clear way. Okay, thank you.
Books for sale by the Warner Bookstore, the Blue Sun Family Exhibition Gallery, Mr. Goodrich, we have his son in college.